We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry with overpriced, underperforming products, and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
And away we go, episode 149 of the Al Galdi Podcast. It is Tuesday, September 21st, 2021, the day on which the Washington football team begins practicing in preparation for quite the challenge this Sunday afternoon at the Buffalo Bills at 1. Washington had a nice little break off the 30-29 win over the New York Giants at FedEx Field last Thursday night, but there can be no resting on your laurels, or as Keyshawn Johnson once said, resting on your morals. Neither means of resting is good. We never rest on this podcast. We are always hard at work for you, the DC Sports Warrior. We follow sports so you don't have to. That's one of my mantras for this podcast. Hello and welcome to a Tuesday installment of the Al Galdi Podcast. No other DC Sports podcast or show like this one. New episode each weekday, Monday through Friday. Each episode out by 5 a.m. Unless we have something like that game this past Thursday night. I wasn't able to publish the episode for this past Friday, episode 147, until after 5 a.m. on Friday. My apologies for that, but getting out a proper show that went in-depth as it needed to on a glorious game that ended up ending right around midnight, that required some time. So I thought better to sacrifice the 5 a.m. thing for one day than to sacrifice the quality of the program, or the program, as some people like to say. But barring the unusual, each episode is out by 5 a.m. and many times out earlier than 5 a.m. Spread the word. If you know of people frustrated with DC Sports Talk Radio, as I know many are, if you know of people looking for more or better content on the Washington football team, let those people know about the Al Galdi Podcast. Spread the word. Testify, if you will.
Oh, my brother, testify!
Yes, thank you, Brother Devon. Testify. Well, I have a very special guest for you on this show regarding the Washington football team. He will testify. Washington football team analyst Mark Bullock. He'll be with me next segment. Mark Bullock is terrific when it comes to doing film breakdowns of the Washington football team. Mark's really good at explaining these film breakdowns. Now that my good pal Chris Cooley isn't doing film breakdowns like he used to, Mark Bullock may well be the best when it comes to doing film breakdowns of the Washington football team. And so you're going to hear Mark Bullock tell us what the tape has revealed over Washington's first two games regarding Taylor Heinicke, Terry McLaurin, Washington's defense as a whole, Chase Young, William Jackson III, Landon Collins, and more. You do not want to miss Mark. And again, he's coming up next segment. Now, I mentioned Taylor Heinicke. Also on the show, I have for you two stunning stats for Heinicke of what he has done so far as a Washington quarterback. These stats floored me when I saw them on Monday. These stats further amplify how well Heinicke has played, and these stats make the Taylor Heinicke deniers, the Taylor Heinicke haters, the Tay-Tay haters, the Taters, look even more foolish. And I want to begin talking about this Sunday's game. Big challenge for the Washington football team at the Buffalo Bills. I will explore three intriguing storylines for this game. Also on the show, controversy in a wild game for the Nationals on Monday night. The Trey Turner runner interference rule back to doing the Nats dirty again, even with Trey Turner no longer on the Nats. Josh Bell was the culprit this time. You're going to hear a furious Davey Martinez from late night on Monday night. And there was a lot more that went on in what ended up being an 8-7, 10-inning loss at the Miami Marlins. We had a much cleaner game for the Orioles on Monday night, a 2-0 win at the Philadelphia Phillies. John Means was really good. I'll discuss that late in the show. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. Email from Robert Delaney on FedEx Field for Washington's win over the Giants this past Thursday night. Writes Robert, so glad they appeased the people who wanted the name change, and now the real fans won't buy tickets. Quick other item, hope you're watching Malik Willis. Yeah, my man Robert is a big Liberty fan. Malik Willis is the Liberty quarterback, and he has been killing it so far this season. Malik Willis, in fact, is number one in the FBS in ESPN's total QBR right now. He has been phenomenal so far this season. When it comes to the attendance for this past Thursday night, so paid attendance at FedEx Field was 50,118. The game was far from a sellout. A capacity at FedEx, for those who don't know, is 82,000. There clearly were a lot of Giants fans at FedEx on Thursday night. That was, though, a hot crowd, and the stadium got really loud as the game went on. FedEx Field immediately after the Taylor Heinicke touchdown pass to Ricky Seals-Jones was as loud as I've heard FedEx Field be in a while. Look, it's going to take a long time to get FedEx Field or wherever the Washington football team plays its home games to routinely being sold out. The goal for the team for now needs to be to give those fans who do attend games the best experiences possible. And those experiences being good starts with the team being good. And when it comes to the name change, while yes, that has angered plenty of people, Washington was having major attendance problems long before the name change. So while the name change may not have helped, I don't think that things would be significantly different if the team was still the Redskins. Email from Kim on Washington's quarterback situation. Writes Kim, I think it's interesting that the WFT waives Steven Montez, and then when Fitz goes down, we pick up a rando. The odds of Heinicke staying healthy are slim, just the facts. That leaves Kyle Allen, and the QB3 is now QB2. You'd think that someone who is in the system like Montez would be valuable. I don't earn the big coaching bucks, but it seems irrational to me. Yeah, so Washington released Steven Montez in the cut down to 53 on August 31st. He then was signed by the Detroit Lions, their practice squad. It may well be that he was offered a spot on Washington's practice squad, but declined because, yeah, you would think that Washington would rather have Montez on the practice squad than Kyle Shurmur, who the team just signed now 2 Mondays ago, September 13th. Well, hopefully we are done with Washington quarterbacks getting injured this season. Hopefully Washington never has to go to Kyle Shurmur, and hopefully things are going great in your life. We always hope that things are going great in your life, but we know that it's not always the case that things are going great in your life. Bad things happen, and I want to tell you about a law firm that is ready to represent you if you've been wronged. Paulson and Nace. Paulson and Nace handles complex personal injury, medical negligence, and wrongful death cases. The services of Paulson and Nace are available in D.C., Maryland, and West Virginia. Paulson and Nace is a family law firm. The Naces are DMV through and through, big Washington football team fans. Paulson and Nace has decades of experience trying cases to jury verdicts and fighting for those injured through no fault of their own. Barry Nace and Chris Nace are both past presidents of the D.C. trial lawyers. Look, I've known the Naces for 25 plus years. These are good people and smart people who are excellent at what they do. Paulson and Nace has recovered millions of dollars for the sick and injured. It's very simple. If you have a case, contact Paulson and Nace. If you feel as if you've been wronged, if you have a complex personal injury, medical negligence, or wrongful death case, or you think that you may have one but aren't sure, call Paulson and Nace and schedule a no-obligation appointment. Yeah, you're obligated to nothing. You can call Paulson and Nace at 202-851-9899. That's 202-851-9899. When you call, make sure that you tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. Make sure that you say, hey, I heard about you guys on the Al Galdi podcast. Here's what I got going on. Schedule a no-obligation appointment by calling 202-851-9899. You're not sure, you have questions, call Paulson and Nace and see what Paulson and Nace has to say. That phone number again, 202-851-9899. Paulson and Nace, when tragedy happens, let their family take care of yours. All right, very pleased to welcome to the Al Galdi podcast right now a special guest, Washington football team analyst Mark Bullock, one of the best guys out there when it comes to doing film breakdowns of the Washington football team. You can see and read Mark's work on Substack, markbullock.substack.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at @markbullockNFL. He is based in England, although for this show, he's coming to us from Sweden. So this is an international man, to be sure, and he knows his stuff. Mark, it's great to have you on again, man. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thanks. How are you?
Doing well. Appreciate you coming on very much. So I first had you on the podcast back in March to preview free agency for Washington. A lot has happened since then. You have studied Washington's first two games. Let's start with something simple. Who are the Washington players who have impressed you the most through two games? Like, you just had to bullet point a handful of guys. Who are those guys?
Yeah, I think on the defensive side, Jonathan Allen has been a clear standout. Obviously, he has the three sacks, and you know, that's more than what he had last year in total. But last year, he was still a very good player, and he got his big contract. He earned that, and has so far been probably their best player on defense. So he's been the standout on defense for me. I think Cameron Curl at safety has also been very good, and it's a little bit puzzling why he hasn't played more snaps, and that's not to say he hasn't played a lot of snaps, but he's always been that third safety in the rotation, and to me, he probably should be the priority. Offensively, I think we've seen some pretty good stuff from Taylor Heineke. Obviously, Terry McLaurin had a big game against the Giants, I think his presence really impacted what the Chargers did defensively, because they played a lot of things to try to take him away. So McLaurin has had a pretty big impact. And then I've also been impressed with center Chase Roullier. I think he's done a really good job with the offensive line, especially in the run game, not only with his blocks and making his blocks, but also the center's always in charge of all the targeting and who goes to which player and who makes which block, and they've been pretty good up front in that regard. So he's been impressive as well.
So you mentioned Taylor Heineke. You on your Substack did a great breakdown of Heineke's performance in the win over the Giants last Thursday night. Was his performance as good as the excitement from the game would suggest?
it had moments of being as good as that excitement. I think the late fourth quarter drive where he suddenly sparked into life and they had that two-play, 75-yard drive, that was outstanding. And the drive to set them up in field goal position for the game winner, that was solid as well. I thought he had some issues with accuracy and ball placement throughout the game. And I think everyone could see that. Like there was a lot of throws that were high. There was a lot of throws that were behind receivers. And guys like Terry McLaurin bailed him out a few times on those. Having to make adjustments to make the catches. But, you know, receivers are paid money to do that too. He did complete the passes, but ideally you'd want them to be a little bit more out in front where they lead the receiver onto them. And that can be down to a few things, like the high throws can be he's not stepping into his throws properly, he's not transferring his weight properly, and that comes with just playing more. And the ball placement can be just from, you know, he's been practicing mostly with the second team, and suddenly he's been thrown into the first team on a short week with very little reps to practice with those guys. So that can throw off the timing issues as well.
So the biggest obstacle for Heinicke being a starting quarterback in the NFL would probably just be his durability, right? He's had a really hard time staying healthy. But in terms of his actual play, what to you is the biggest worry with Heinicke?
I think he's probably a little bit too risky. And if he has the ball placement issues that he had on Thursday, then that's going to lead to interceptions because he can try to. You like a quarterback to be confident and trying to fit the ball into tight windows and push the ball down the field. That's not a bad trait in and of itself. But if you don't have the arm strength to really drive the ball into those tight windows and the accuracy to place it where only the receiver can get it, and that's not to say Heinicke has a bad arm or is inaccurate, but we saw he had issues with ball placement, and he doesn't have the most amazing arm. It's not a Aaron Rodgers or Josh Allen or Patrick Mahomes kind of arm, so he's not really driving that ball in there with a huge amount of velocity. So the issue with taking those aggressive shots is if you don't put the ball in the right spot, then it's going to lead to interceptions, and I think we'll probably see that at some point this season. But you still want him to have an aggressive mindset, but it can work against him as well.
The sample size obviously is so small, but just given what you've observed, do you think that Taylor Heinicke can be a viable starting quarterback in the NFL?
I don't know about... He's not necessarily someone I think is going to be their guy for the next 10 years. He's not someone that would, I think, is, you know... You just drafted a first-round pick, and you're battling through the roughs that come with that, and you know long-term he's going to pan out. I think he's a guy that can be serviceable, and I think in the long-term he's probably a really nice backup quarterback at best, and someone that could come in, spot start for you, and do a decent job, especially in this offense, knowing this system as much as he does. But I think the durability, as you mentioned, like this was the first game that he's managed to finish in the NFL without getting injured. So that's a huge part of it. And I think once teams start to get a larger sample size on him and throw some different looks at him and see, hey, he doesn't react well to this kind of blitz, or he doesn't react well to this kind of coverage, we'll get to see a more true look at exactly what he is as an NFL quarterback.
Talking with Washington football team analyst Mark Bullock, one of the best guys when it comes to doing film breakdowns of the Washington football team. You can see and read his work on Substack, markbullock.substack.com. So Terry McLaurin, he in the loss to the Chargers in week one targeted just 4 times. He in the win over the Giants in week two targeted 14 times. Were there schematic reasons for the discrepancy in targets, or did McLaurin get so many more targets in week two because of Washington just having the ball more than Washington had the ball in week one, and perhaps Washington making more of an effort to target McLaurin in week two?
Yeah, it was perhaps a little bit of both. In that first game against the Chargers, the Chargers played it very defensively against McLaurin. They played a lot of two deep safeties, and they rotated coverage to McLaurin. And basically, from the first play of the game, they said, we're bracketing McLaurin with two defenders. You're not going to beat us by throwing to McLaurin. And Washington, to their credit, I think they had a decent game plan, and obviously it didn't pan out. But I think when the Chargers set out to play two deep defenders pretty much the entire game. They knew that the Washington knew that the Chargers would be light in the box, and they ran the ball well, and they had basically 5 yards of carry. So it's not that they didn't plan well, and they schemed up some shots to other players by using McLaurin as a decoy, and we saw that on the deep ball to De'Ami Brown that got the pass interference. That was a shot where Terry McLaurin at one stage had three defenders on him, and that left Brown one-on-one. So they did. It's not like Washington didn't know that's what the Chargers were doing, and they had plans to attack that. So the Chargers were definitely trying to take away McLaurin, whereas the Giants, they did not set out to take away McLaurin in anywhere near the same fashion, and that obviously opens up a hell of a lot more to McLaurin, and perhaps there was a little bit of compensating for the lack of targets in that first game by saying, well, they're not doubling McLaurin every play, let's go to him a lot more often.
So you and your Substack also have done a lot of work with the Washington defense. This obviously has been a big topic. Just generally speaking, what things have struck you as the biggest reasons for the disappointing performances from Washington's defense so far?
So obviously the third downs were a huge issue against the Chargers, and they felt like they were against the Giants. Although when you go back and look at the numbers, they only gave up 4 of 12 officially. Now that's a little bit misleading because they also had two killer penalties from Collins and then Kendall Fuller on third downs, which effectively gave them conversions that didn't count as official conversions. So they effectively gave up 6 third down conversions. But obviously the third downs has to improve. And against the Giants, I think they had some busts where they were trying to do different things on different sides of the field and it didn't quite mesh. They were playing a lot of combination coverages. So they were playing some cover 6 at times where on one half of the field it's quarters coverage or cover 4. On the other half of the field it's cover 2. And when the receivers cross the middle of the field, that can make things a little bit messy with how things get passed off. And I think Washington had one or two busts with regards to that. And then also there was the issues with the run game and obviously Daniel Jones with the zone read or the read option really, really hit them. And they didn't do a good job of defending that at all. They really struggled. And the Giants, for me, the Giants should have run that every play until Washington confirmed that they could stop it. That they did make some adjustments to that in the second half and they were a little more aggressive attacking the mesh point. But it still wasn't convincing to me, but the Giants went away from it.
So that's the what. What about the why? Like, why are pass catchers running so wide open? Do you think the defense is too complicated? You know, Ron has talked about guys not being where they're supposed to be and guys not being disciplined enough and guys perhaps freelancing. It strikes me as troubling that these things are happening. I mean, there are plenty of veterans on this defense. What do you think is behind what we're seeing defensively?
Yeah, it's a combination of bad play all around, really. We've seen that pass rush up front's not getting enough pressure for as good as it can be or as talented as it is. And that comes back to the coverage not holding up as long as it should and letting those guys get home. So it plays off of each other. I think the coverage issues come from maybe trying to do too much. They were very simple last year with what they tried to do. It was usually cover 3 or quarters, and that was basically it for the most part. Whereas this year they're trying to expand because they've got some better players and they've got more depth in the secondary. And as I said, they've been trying to play combination coverages like cover 6. They've been playing some match quarters, and those kind of coverages, they work really well when they're communicated properly and players are passed off and picked up by the next guy. And I think what we're seeing, certainly what I saw against the Giants, were that they weren't communicating and passing off routes correctly. And that can come from, you know, new guys playing in different spots, and Kendall Fuller's moving back into the slot, and they've got a rookie in Benjamin St. Juice playing outside, and a new safety in Bobby McCain, and you know, that they've got William Jackson, obviously, at corner. That they've got a lot of new faces there, so it takes a little bit of time for those complicated coverages and the communication required to execute those coverages to come together.
We're talking with Washington football team analyst Mark Bullock. He is excellent when it comes to doing film breakdowns of the Washington football team. You can see and read his work on Substack, markbullock.substack.com. I want to get your takes on a few individual players. Chase Young. How has Chase Young played so far?
I don't think it's as bad as people are making out. But obviously, he'd love to have more sacks, and he'd love to have more pressures, and you'd want to see that from him. He is still impacting games. He is still generating pressure. It's probably not as consistent as everyone would like to be. But from both the Chargers and the Giants game, you see he's getting a lot of extra attention. He's quite regularly getting chipped by tight ends or running backs, and offensive lines are quite often sliding his way to give the tackle as much help as possible against him. So he's still having a significant impact on game plans, and offenses still clearly respect the threat that he brings. But part of it is also he's still a young player. He's still developing. He's still maybe perhaps a little bit overly reliant on his athletic ability and his pass rush plan. He does have good techniques, and he does have a plan, but he doesn't always come off of those plans very well and move from and react to different moves effectively, and that just comes with experience. So he's still got developing to do, and I think we'll see as the season progresses that the more chances he gets to rush and not be playing quick game stuff where the defense is actually covering defenders for longer than 2 or 3 seconds, we'll see him get home a little bit more.
William Jackson III, what are your impressions of him so far?
He's another one that I think has been better than what people think. A lot of people were concerned about the deep ball that Darius Slayton dropped against the Giants, and that for me was partly his fault. It was also partly just the Giants had a good call against the coverage that Washington had, and as much as fans hate to hear that, like, that does happen sometimes. Sometimes the offense just has the right call against your coverage. So he was in a tough spot there. He obviously got beat for another touchdown, and that was just a case of he missed a jam at the line of scrimmage. But he's also had some pretty nice reps as well, especially when he's been playing man coverage. Against the Chargers, they went at him back-to-back with Keenan Allen, and both times he pressed him at the line of scrimmage, pushed him outside, forced him wider to the sideline, closed the throwing window, and both throws were incomplete. So he is having a decent start. It's obviously you don't want to give up that deep touchdown in the Giants game, but I think he's been better than people anticipated and kind of a victim of the whole defense playing poorly.
And one more defensive player for you, Landon Collins. What do you think about him so far?
Yeah, I was more impressed with him in preseason than I have been in the regular season so far. When he came back in the preseason, I was shocked that A, he was back on the field, given how short that recovery from that injury was, and B, how light and fast he looked. He looked, obviously, that they talked about him being back to his college weight rather than his NFL weight, and he moved a lot quicker and seamlessly, and was playing deep a lot more often than he had in the past, and I was encouraged by that. And to a degree, he's been fine, but there have been issues, obviously, that there was the read option play against the Giants where he was the end man on the line of scrimmage that was left unblocked, and people will kill him for that, but it's a tough spot for him to be in because they weren't really playing for the read option. He was the only guy there. They didn't have a linebacker scraping over the top as you typically would, so he was in a lose-lose situation. Either he crashes down on the run and Jones runs by him like he did, or he holds his position and the running back has a free lane right up the middle. So he was in a lose-lose situation either way. So I don't think Washington have necessarily done their best job keeping Collins in his best spots and giving him the best opportunity, but he's also had some issues. And like I said earlier, he had the penalty on a third down play where he tried to jam a tight end at the line of scrimmage, completely missed and ended up holding him and gave up the third down. So he hasn't been amazing, but I don't think he's been terrible by any stretch.
Exit question. So we saw Washington have a lot of trouble with Daniel Jones on Thursday night. This coming Sunday, right, probably a better version of Daniel Jones and Josh Allen, a guy who can throw really well, run really well. Can Washington handle Josh Allen at the Buffalo Bills this Sunday afternoon?
Well, I would say the first thing I'm doing if I'm the Bills offensive coordinator is installing some read options and seeing if Washington can really defend that, because until Washington proves they can stop it, and as I said, they made some adjustments in the second half, but I wasn't convinced that that would definitely stop it. Until they can prove that, I'd be running that all day long. But yeah, I think Josh Allen will certainly give them some issues, and he's got the arm to make the throws. And I don't think he'd miss the deep ball to Slayton that Jones slightly overthrew. And obviously, their weapons outside are pretty good as well, and Stephon Diggs and what have you will be tough for Washington to cover. I do think that the pass rush could get home a little bit more. I think we saw in the first game against the Steelers that the Bills had some issues up front with protection, and Jonathan Allen in particular could get home against the left guard. But yeah, Josh Allen will certainly be a very, very tough test for them.
Excellent insight. Check out his work on Substack, markbullock.substack.com. Mark, it's great to have you on, man. Thank you so much.
Of course, anytime.
All right, good stuff from Mark Bullock, Washington football team analyst, a man who can break down the tape scientifically when it comes to the science of having a good lawn. No company understands that better than Weedman. If you're tired of your lawn not looking as good as you want it to look, if you don't have the time or the knowledge to make your lawn look great, no worries. Let Weedman take care of your lawn. Weedman cares for your lawn, so you don't have to. Weedman provides what your lawn needs to look great: fertilization, weed control, aeration, seeding, and a variety of other services. Weedman is a national network of locally owned franchises, so you'll receive the personal service that you deserve. Weedman answers your phone calls and emails promptly. Weedman does what it says it's going to do. All of that sounds simple, and it is, but it's not nearly as common as it should be. Weedman's products are of the highest quality. Weedman does not cut corners. The best weed controls, state-certified seed. Weedman's secret sauce is the fertilizer. All of Weedman's organic-based fertilizer applications feature 65% super slow-release nitrogen that feeds your roots slowly and effectively. Yeah, Weedman has a mastery of the science behind a great lawn. Now, a beautiful spring lawn starts in the fall, and so Weedman is offering something special to listeners of the Al Galdi podcast: a fall tune-up at a great price, an aeration and two fall fertilization services for just $209. That's 30% off the usual price for those services. That price is a steal. That price applies to lawns of up to 6,000 square feet. So here's what you do. Call 571-340-3400. When you call, make sure that you mention the Al Galdi podcast so you get the special deal. Again, an aeration and two fall fertilization services for just $209. Again, a 30% discount of the usual price for those services. That phone number again, 571-340-3400. And make sure that you mention the Al Galdi podcast so you get the special deal. You can also Google Weedman and make a web request. Just make sure that you mention the Al Galdi podcast. Weedman, a great lawn at a great price with great personal service. Well, since last Thursday night, since the day of Tay-Tay, since Taylor Heinicke did what he did in the Washington football team's 30-29 win over the New York Giants at FedEx Field, there have been multiple stats that illuminate what Heinicke did in that game and what Heinicke has done so far as a Washington quarterback. I've talked about these stats on the podcast. And on Monday, we got two more stats, two advanced stats. And these two really are jaw-droppers. So at the core of Pro Football Focus's evaluations of quarterbacks are two stats in particular: big-time throws and turnover-worthy plays. Now, these are things that are, to a degree, subjective, and they are determined by Pro Football Focus. And so if you don't want to take these stats as gospel, that's fine. I don't take the PFF stuff as gospel, but I do look at the stuff and I do put value in the stuff because the stuff is an attempt, I think a very good attempt, at trying to have a more sophisticated means of evaluating football than just the same old, you know, the same old flawed traditional back of the football card stats and the same old flawed cliche talk from announcers and former players. Big time throws per PFF come in many forms, but PFF has defined a big time throw, quote, as a pass with excellent ball location and timing, generally thrown further down the field and or into a tighter window, end quote. Turnover worthy plays are what they sound like, throws by quarterbacks that are worthy of interceptions but don't necessarily result in interceptions, and fumbles by quarterbacks that are true fumbles, as opposed to, say, fumbles charged to quarterbacks that are the results of botched handoffs that are the faults of running backs. You see, you have to be careful with quarterback fumbles because quarterbacks get charged with fumbles on plays on which the fumbles weren't necessarily the quarterback's fault. So with all of that established, how about this? There now are 45 NFL quarterbacks who have each had at least 100 dropbacks since the start of the 2020 season. And we're talking here regular season and postseason. Taylor Heinicke, among those 45 quarterbacks in that span, is number one in both big-time throw rate and turnover-worthy play rate. He has a big-time throw rate of 8.1%. He has a turnover-worthy play rate of 0.7%. Yeah. Among the 45 NFL quarterbacks who have each had at least 100 dropbacks since the start of the 2020 season, regular season and postseason, the quarterback who is number one in both big-time throw rate and turnover-worthy play rate isn't Patrick Mahomes, isn't Tom Brady, isn't Aaron Rodgers, isn't Lamar Jackson. No. That guy is Taylor Heinicke. As Chase Young sang while he was mic'd up last season.
Let's get it there, Heinicke. Heinicke.
Exactly, Chase. Now, I know these are just stats, and I know the sample size with Taylor Heinicke remains small. But how about that? I mean, seriously, how about that? Taylor Heinicke is number one among the 45 NFL quarterbacks who have each had at least 100 dropbacks since the start of the 2020 season, regular season and postseason, in Pro Football Focus's big-time throw rate and turnover-worthy play rate. And to be number one in both of those things is remarkable for any quarterback. Because on the one hand, if you're making a bunch of big-time throws, you're throwing downfield, you are, in theory, exposing yourself to turnover-worthy plays, and yet to have the high big-time throw rate while also having the low turnover-worthy play rate, that's phenomenal, and that's precisely what Taylor Heinicke has done. And specific to the turnover-worthy play rate, that spits right in the face of this narrative from some fans and from a bunch of people in the media mob, that the guy makes all of these dangerous passes and takes way too many risks and is a four-interception game waiting to happen. The guy has the lowest turnover-worthy play rate of any quarterback with at least 100 dropbacks since the start of last season, regular season, and postseason. The lowest. Not like kind of low, sort of low. No, the lowest. The lowest of the lows. I am sure that the Taylor Heinicke deniers, the Taylor Heinicke haters, the taters, as I call them, will continue to come up with reasons to knock the guy and not believe in the guy. I am sure that the taters will continue to move the goalposts. You've noticed that, right? That the goalposts for Taylor Heinicke keep moving. We've gone from Heinicke has no chance of playing well in the wild card game against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at FedEx Field last postseason. So Heinicke has no chance of being Washington's starting quarterback for the 2021 season. To now, Heinicke has no chance of being Washington's long-term starting quarterback. Pretty soon, the only thing that the Taters will have left to say is, yeah, but he won't be a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Let's get it there, Heinicke! Heinicke!
Yes, Chase, Heinicke. As I keep saying, I don't know what Taylor Heinicke is going to end up being. I am not certain of what Taylor Heinicke is going to end up being. Unlike the Taters being so certain of what this guy can't be, all I have said is that I want to see more. That's it. Because I don't know. I'm intrigued and I want to see more. Well, we saw more last Thursday night and the more was glorious. And the numbers back up that he was glorious. And while it could be that he's about to come crashing back down to earth, it could also be that he isn't. The only thing that's for sure right now with Taylor Heinicke is that nothing's for sure. Big test for Heinicke this Sunday afternoon at the Buffalo Bills in what is a game with multiple intriguing storylines. I'll explore three of those storylines after this. Washington football team season is in full swing, and there's no need to exhaust yourself searching all over the internet to find Washington football team tickets. That's because TickPick, that's T-I-C-K-P-I-C-K, is the original no-fee ticket site and the only ticket site that you'll ever need as your go-to for all NFL tickets. TickPick got rid of all of those awful service fees that the other ticket sites charge. This allows TickPick to guarantee the best prices on all of its NFL tickets. Don't believe this? Look, if you can find better prices for the same seats on another ticket site, TickPick will give you 110% of the difference in the purchase price. We're all excited to watch the WFT this season. Whether you're looking to watch Young Sweat and the defense battle Mahomes and the Chiefs or Brady and the Bucks at home, or wanting to travel with McLaurin and the guys to watch them play at Rodgers and the Pack or at Carr and the Raiders, or you want to hit up the division games, TickPick has you covered. Again, TickPick guarantees the best prices on all of its NFL tickets. No more of those ridiculous service fees. So here's what you do. Visit TickPick.com/Galdi right now and use the promo code Galdi to save $10 on your first order of Washington football team tickets. That's TickPick.com/Galdi and use the promo code Galdi. TickPick.com/Galdi and make sure that you use the promo code Galdi.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry with overpriced, underperforming products and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
All right, so as the Washington football team on Tuesday is beginning the team's practice week for the Sunday afternoon's game at the Buffalo Bills, I wanted to note a few things with this game. First of all, this game is an opportunity for Washington to do something that Washington has rarely done over the last decade plus. Begin a season 2-1 or better. Do you know that Washington has started a season 2-1 or better just 3 times over the last 12 seasons? Yeah, that's it. Washington has started a season 2-1 or better just 3 times over the last 12 seasons. I mean, it's not like 2-1 is some white hot start to a season, and yet a start that good or better has happened just 3 times over the last 12 seasons. Talking about 2009 through 2020. Washington started 2-1 in each of these 3 seasons, 2011, 2017, and 2018. Each of the other 9 seasons over the previous 12 seasons has seen Washington start 1-2 or 0-3. Forget about 3-0. Washington has not started a season 3-0 since 2005. One of the more frustrating things about being a fan of the team, currently known as the Washington football team, for years now, has been the constant slow starts to seasons. Washington almost never begins a season fast. Washington is almost always in an early hole in a season. I talked after the 2016 loss to the Los Angeles Chargers at FedEx Field in Week 1 how that loss continued Washington's struggles in Week 1 games. Washington now is just 2-6. Over its last 8 Week 1 games. The 2 wins, 24-6 at the Arizona Cardinals in Week 1 of the 2018 season and 27-17 over the Philadelphia Eagles at FedEx Field in Week 1 of the 2020 season. But it's not just that Washington consistently loses Week 1 games, it's that Washington is consistently 1-2 or worse after 3 games. Now, obviously, 1-2 is in some insurmountable hole. And as we know, Washington's thing is to rally to make the postseason. Each of Washington's last 5 playoff seasons has been a season in which the team rallied from a hole earlier in the season. 2005, Washington went from 5-6 to 10-6. 2007, Washington went from 5-7 to 9-7. 2012, Washington went from 3-6 to 10-6. 2015, Washington went from 5-7 to 9-7. 2020, Washington went from 1-5 to 7-9. All 5 of those seasons were playoff seasons. But is it not maddening that our team, like never, gets off to a great start? And not that 2-1 would be some great start, but it would be nice, wouldn't it? So this game at the Bills on Sunday afternoon is a chance for Washington to do something that the team rarely has done for years now. Now, as you may have seen, Washington is a big underdog for Sunday afternoon at the Bills. Washington, per Caesars Sportsbook, as of early Tuesday morning, was a 9-point underdog, second biggest dog in NFL Week 3. And so here's something else. Washington winning at the Bills on Sunday afternoon would mark Washington's biggest outright win as an underdog since, believe it or not, Ron Rivera's final game as Carolina Panthers head coach. As you likely know, Ron's final game as Panthers head coach was a Washington win at Carolina, 29-21 in Week 13 of the 2019 season. For Pro Football Reference, Washington was a 10.5-point underdog for that game. That surprised me when I looked that up. I did not remember Washington being that big of an underdog for that game. I mean, that was not a great Panthers team that season, and yet Washington was a 10.5-point underdog for that game. Per Pro Football Reference, Washington's biggest outright win as an underdog last season was the 23-17 win at the Pittsburgh Steelers in Week 13. Washington was a 6.5-point underdog for that game. Now, we'll see what happens with the line for Washington at Buffalo as the week progresses. Maybe the line comes down, but for now, a Washington win at the Bills on Sunday afternoon would be a big deal from a gambling perspective. And then one more storyline for Washington at Buffalo. And not that one game is the determinant for something like this, but it's interesting to note that when it comes to the peak of the Carolina Panthers during Ron Rivera's time as their head coach, Washington has Ron and, of course, Marty Herney, but the Bills have Sean McDermott and Brandon Bean. And there is a belief that the Bills have the better of the brain trust. The Bills in January 2017 hired Sean McDermott as head coach off him having spent the previous six seasons, 2011 through 2016, as Carolina Panthers defensive coordinator. The Bills in May 2017 hired Brandon Bean as general manager. He had an incredible rise with the Panthers from 1998 to 2017. Bean joined the Panthers in their communications department in 1998 and rose all the way to assistant general manager in June 2015. The Bills went 17 consecutive seasons without a playoff appearance, but now have made the playoffs three times over the last four seasons with McDermott as head coach and Bean as GM. The Bills did not make the playoffs from the 2000 season through the 2016 season, but now have made the playoffs in three of the last four seasons, 2017, 2019, and 2020. McDermott and Bean have done an excellent job with the Bills. And that's not to say that Ron and Marty can't do an excellent job with Washington, but there's still a lot that we need to see with Ron and Marty with Washington. We've seen enough from McDermott and Bean with the Bills to know that those guys are getting the job done. And know this too, a knock on Ron is that his Panthers defenses were not the same after McDermott left after his six seasons as Panthers defensive coordinator. McDermott was Ron's defensive coordinator for the Panthers from 2011 through 2016 before becoming Bill's head coach. Now, in fairness to Ron, his Panthers for the 2017 regular season, so that first regular season after McDermott left to become Bill's head coach, were number seven in the NFL in total defense per Football Outsiders DVOA metrics. So it's not like Ron's Panthers defenses in the post-McDermott era were totally inept, but overall, Ron's Panthers defenses in the post-McDermott era were not as good as Ron's Panthers defenses during the McDermott era. And just like people said of Jay Gruden that his Washington offenses were not the same after Sean McVay left, people have said of Ron Rivera that his Panthers defenses were not the same after Sean McDermott left. This is a big game on Sunday afternoon, Washington at Buffalo. It's a big game for plenty of reasons, and there's a lot to be thinking about with this game. Well, we on Monday night had game one of a three-game series between two of the worst teams in the National League, the two worst teams in the National League East. The baseball was wild, the baseball was sloppy, and the baseball resulted in controversy. Yes, controversy between two teams that, as of this Tuesday, are a combined 50 games below 500. Make no mistake, these were two loser teams on display on Monday night. The Nationals lost at the Miami Marlins 8-7 in 10 innings on Monday night. Nats now are 61-89 on the season. But the headline item from this game ends up being an old Nationals nemesis. Yes, an old Nats nemesis reared its ugly head. That nemesis, the runner interference rule, aka the Trey Turner rule, although now we perhaps have to call this the Trey Turner / Josh Bell rule. So here's what happened. Josh Bell in the top of the 10th with one out, the bases loaded, and the game tied at 7, grounded into a 3-2-3 double play for the final 2 outs. But what happened was Bell was called out for running out of the baseline. Bell, in running, took the glove off of the Marlins first baseman, Lewin Diaz, and Bell took the baseball off his back. As the ball was being thrown from Marlins catcher Nick Fortes to Marlins first baseman Lewin Diaz, the ball hit Bell on the back. Bell took off the glove of Diaz, but Bell was ruled out. Now, Bell did run outside of the baseline. He did run onto the infield grass during part of his run to first base. That's a no-no. So you could argue that the rule was properly applied. But here's the thing about this rule. It is often misconstrued. The rule isn't that the runner is out if he runs inside the first baseline. The rule is that the runner is out if he runs inside the first baseline and in doing so interferes with the fielder taking the throw at first base. And it is debatable whether Josh Bell did that because the throw from the Marlins catcher Nick Fortes was not good. The problem with this rule is that it inevitably rewards a player for a bad throw to first base. And that's what ended up happening on Monday night. Davey Martinez was irate, even though Davey couldn't come out from the dugout to argue because of the recent procedure on his leg. Ryan Zimmerman, who was on deck and who like never argues anything, at least not verbally, at least not obviously, he was furious. I mean, Zimmerman was going off so much so that he flirted with being tossed from the game. But of course, for the Nationals, this is a very familiar situation. What happened with Josh Bell on Monday night marked the third time in 2 years that the Nats were plagued by this rule. Each of the first 2 times involved Trey Turner. The first time came on October 29th, 2019, the Nationals 7-2 win at the Houston Astros in World Series Game 6. Trey Turner in that game called out for running inside the first baseline in the top of the 7th inning. Yan Gomes was on first, no outs. Nats were nursing a 3-2 lead. Trey hit a weak first pitch grounder off the ex-Nat Brad Peacock toward the third base side in front of the mound. Peacock fielded the ball, fired a throw to first baseman Yuli Gurriel. The ball and Turner collided with Gurriel's glove, resulting in the ball going down the right field line into foul territory and Gomes advancing to third and Turner advancing to second. But the home plate umpire, Sam Holbrook, soon called Turner out for interference, which also meant that Gomes had to return to first. Davey came out of the dugout to dispute the call, but because the decision was considered a judgment call, the play was not reviewable. Then, earlier this season, this whole thing popped up again. A 4-3 Nationals win at the Chicago Cubs this past May 19th. Turner was called out for running inside the first baseline and attempting to get to first base on a wild pitch on a swing and miss strike three to begin the top of the 7th. Turner was called out despite literally running straight down the first baseline and then the throw going behind him. Davey came out to argue, was immediately ejected for walking onto the field of play. He then, though, got his money's worth. You may remember this. Davey ended up ripping first base out of the ground, although it took a few seconds. It was a little awkward for a while as Davey struggled to rip first base out of the ground. And then he spiked first base and kicked first base. It was a great tantrum by Davey Martinez. Well, Davey could not throw a tantrum on Monday night because of the recent procedure on his leg, but Davey could sound off. This was Davey Martinez late night on Monday night during his post-game Zoom press conference. Davey was livid. Take a listen, and you will, during this, hear a follow-up question from Nats insider Jesse Docherty of the Washington Post.
We're going to let that play to me. I'm going to say this, it's a cluster, right? It's a judgment. They say it's a judgment. He ran inside. By the time when he touched the base, the ball hit him in the back. He was already on the base. It's a judgment at that point. I get it. If the ball hits him inside the line, that's, you know, and he's still running, yeah, great. But come on, guys, use your freaking common sense. One time. It's a brutal freaking play. It really is. I mean, it's horrible.
Do you feel that because they maybe saw him going inside the line, that's why they
might ask to justify exactly, it? Let the play finish. It's a judgment, right? Yeah. Don't start calling him, and the guy hasn't even thrown the ball. You know, the ball, he's running, the guy's got the ball in his hand, and when he touches the base, he gets in the back. And they call him out?
Yeah, I love it, man. I love when Davey gets fired up like that. Good for him. It's been a frustrating season. Good for him for letting off some of the steam with what happened there on Monday night. Look, the umpires have got to do a better job of interpreting this rule. Again, the rule isn't that if you're inside the first baseline, you're automatically out. There needs to be more of an acceptance of, yeah, you may be doing something bad and running inside the first baseline, but that doesn't mean that you materially affected the outcome of the play. At the same time, I mean, Josh Bell needs to know better. He can't be running on the infield grass as he ended up doing and route to first base on that play. But anyway, none of this should have really mattered, or at least none of this could have mattered if not for a terrible base running blunder by Luis Garcia. Luis Garcia was the Nats' automatic runner on second base to begin the top of the 10th with the game tied at 7. Lane Thomas led off the top of the 10th with an opposite field double to right field. But Garcia inexplicably didn't score from second base. Yeah, Garcia was on second base, but he only advanced one base on a double. He apparently thought that the ball might be caught. Okay, fine. Was waiting to tag up. Okay, I guess. But he could have made his way at least a third of the way toward third base, if not halfway toward third base, and then had enough time to retreat to second base. And, you know, maybe tagging up would have been a little harder in doing it that way, but he still should have had ample opportunity to tag up with where that baseball was going. Deep right field, really near the right field corner. But Luis Garcia ended up playing things so conservatively that he ended up advancing just one base on a two-base hit. I don't know that I've ever seen that before in watching baseball. That was awful. Okay, I mean, that was amateur hour. And then you just knew that that would come back to haunt the Nats with them not scoring in that top of the 10th inning. And then, especially after the Josh Bell play, you just knew that the Nats would give up a run in the bottom of the 10th inning and lose the game. And sure enough, that's precisely what happened. Sam Clay allowed the unearned game-winning run in the bottom of the 10th on an intentional walk, a stolen base, and a walk-off wild pitch. Just amazing. Josh Bell did have a good game. I mean, it almost feels silly noting this, but so he was an at starting left fielder. He went 1-for-4 with a double and two walks, and he made a nice catch. Bell in the Nats' two-run first drew a one-out six-pitch walk despite having been down to the count of 1.02. Bell in the Nats' three-run fifth had an opposite field ground rule double to right field. Bell in the top of the eighth drew a two-out eight-pitch walk, and Bell made a nice leaping backhanded catch against the outfield wall of a deep full-count flyout by Lewis Brinson for the first out in the bottom of the second. The ball appeared as if it would have been a home run had Bell not made the catch. So dare I say a home run saving catch by Josh Bell? A home run robbing catch by Josh Bell? You know, Bell has played more and more in left field over these last few weeks. I mean, he's still a primary first baseman, but Davey Martinez has added some, wait for it, position flex to Josh Bell.
Position flex?
Yes, Ron, position flex in getting Josh Bell some reps in left field. And it's been kind of funny because for all of the time that Josh Bell has been spending in left field, the baseballs really had not been finding Josh Bell. He really had not had that many defensive opportunities as a left fielder. He gets a big one on Monday night and he comes through with a home run robbing catch. Luis Garcia, look, the base running boo-boo in the top of the 10th was really bad. But Luis did have two hits on Monday night. Garcia in the Nats' three-run fifth had a one-out opposite field RBI double to left field for a 6-3 Nats lead. And Garcia in the Nats' one-run seventh had a one-out infield single off a nice diving stop by the Marlins' third baseman, Eddie Alvarez. The Garcia base-running blunder is what sticks with you. Also for the Nats in this 8-7-10 inning loss at the Marlins on Monday night, major defensive sloppiness from Alcides Escobar. Now, Escobar did go 3-for-6 with three singles, but he also committed two crucial defensive miscues. So with the singles, Escobar in the Nats' two-run first had a single as he gently poked a low and away pitch into left center field. Escobar in the top of the second had a two-out single. Escobar in the top of the sixth had a leadoff single. Okay, great. But Escobar also had two big defensive miscues in three-run innings for the Marlins. Escobar in the Marlins' three-run third committed a two-out fielding error on a grounder by Brian De La Cruz as Escobar failed to field the grounder, and then the ball went up and like off the heel of his glove. And Escobar in the Marlins' three-run seventh failed in an attempted pick of a two-out grounder up the middle by Lewis Brinson. The Marlins on the play tied the game at 7. Each Escobar miscue happened with him running to his left towards second base. Each Escobar miscue was perhaps the result of Escobar being a bit too casual. I'm not a mind reader, so I don't know what he was thinking, but the two miscues were similar in nature, and the two miscues ended up looming large. Some more positives for the Nats in this game on Monday night. K-Bear Ruiz, 3-for-5 with two-run singles and another single. Hopefully he's finally coming around offensively. I mean, we've talked about this with Ruiz. He does make a lot of contact. So you always kind of felt like, all right, it's just a matter of him making some better contact, him, you know, hitting some balls to where fielders are not. Ruiz on Monday night, two big hits especially. Ruiz in the Nats 2-run first had a 2-out bases loaded, 2-run single for a 2-0 Nats lead as he did a nice job of fighting off an inside pitch into shallow left field. Ruiz in the Nats 3-run fifth had a 1-out tie-breaking 2-run single down the right field line for a 5-3 Nats lead as Ruiz again did a good job of turning on an inside pitch. And Ruiz in the top of the ninth had a leadoff single on a 1-2 pitch. His numbers so far at the major league level for the Nats are not good, but he has had some multi-hit games here lately, and 3-for-5 with 4 RBI was K-Bert Ruiz on Monday night. Lane Thomas had another big game on Monday night, 2-for-5 with a solo homer, a double, and a walk. Thomas in the Nats 2-run first, drawing a leadoff 7-pitch walk despite having been down in the count of 1.12. Thomas in the top of the second, smashing a 2-out full count solo homer to center field for a 3-0 Nats lead despite having been down in that count at 1.12. And that was some home run, the homer going a projected 413 feet per Statcast. We saw a lot of long home runs on Monday night. More on some of the others in just a bit. And Thomas in the top of the 10th smashed that leadoff opposite field double to right field, although Luis Garcia inexplicably did not score from second base as the automatic runner. Now, Thomas did commit a fielding error. The error ended up not being of much consequence, but the error happened on a Lewis Brinson, went out full count single in the bottom of the sixth as Thomas had problems making an attempted backhanded stab of the single off a bounce. This, again, was sloppy from the Nationals. Two bad teams were going at it on Monday night in front of literally dozens at the Marlins' home ballpark. But Lane Thomas does continue to hit 146 Major League plate appearances now for Lane Thomas with the Nats. Batting average of .302, on base percentage of .390, slugging percentage of .548. Also, Juan Soto on base a bunch more times. I mean, this is all this guy does right now is get on base multiple times. He got on base 4 times in this game on Monday night. 1-for-3 with a single and 3 walks. Soto in the top of the second, a 2-out single on an 0-2 pitch. Soto in the Nats 3-run fifth drew a leadoff 5-pitch walk. Soto in the top of the sixth drew a 4-pitch walk. Soto in the top of the 10th drew a 1-out intentional walk. His major league leading on base percentage is up to .461. His major league leading walks total is up to 127. In terms of the Nats pitching, so Eric Fetty was the Nats starting pitcher, and Fetty was so-so at best, and calling the outing so-so may be being generous. So he allowed 4 runs, 2 earned in 5 innings. He gave up just 4 hits, but they were 3 home runs and a single. He did have 5 strikeouts versus no walks, that's good, but he threw 96 pitches over the 5 innings. Fetty allowed 3 runs, 1 earned in the bottom of the third. He retired the first 2 batters he faced, but then came trouble. Fetty gave up a 2-out solo homer by Jazz Chisholm Jr. on a bomb to the upper deck in right field. The homer went a projected 415 feet per Statcast. Felt like the home run went much further than just 415 feet, but that was some shot by Jazz Chisholm Jr. Then came the fielding error by Alcides Escobar. And then Fetty gave up another home run, gave up a 2-out game-tying 2-run homer by Jesus Sanchez to right center field to tie the game at 3. That home run went a projected 421 feet per Statcast. Fetty allowed a run in the bottom of the fifth on a 2-out full-count solo homer by Jazz Chisholm Jr. to center field to cut the Nats' lead to 6-4. So, you know, another outing in which, okay, this was okay, that was okay, but this still has been a very disappointing season ultimately for Eric Fetty. He now over 26 starts this season, has an ERA of 5.10. He does continue to get some strikeouts, so give him credit for that. His strikeouts per 9 innings is at a career best 8.86, but an ERA over 5, over 26 starts. I mean, I'm sorry. Like, how do you say that that is anything but disappointing for a 2014 first-round pick in Eric Fetty? The Nats bullpen on Monday night. So you had Alberto Baldonado tossing a scoreless bottom of the sixth with 2 strikeouts. You had Patrick Murphy and Austin Voth combining to allow 3 runs in the bottom of the seventh. You had Andres Machado tossing a perfect bottom of the eighth with two strikeouts. You had Sam Clay, like I said, giving it up in the bottom of the 10th, allowing the unearned game-winning run. But what to me stands out more than anything when it comes to the Nats bullpen on Monday night, Tanner Rainey. Tanner Rainey is on fire right now. Tanner Rainey tossed a perfect bottom of the 9th with three strikeouts to preserve a 7-all tie. This was Rainey's second appearance in as many days. Rainey, in the 3-0 win over the Colorado Rockies at Nationals Park on Sunday afternoon, tossed a perfect top of the 7th with three strikeouts. The Nats on Saturday recalled Rainey from AAA Rochester and optioned Wander Suero to Rochester. The Nats had optioned Rainey to Rochester all the way back on August 1st. He had been having a nightmare of a season. Rainey, at the time of being optioned to Rochester, 25 major league innings this season, ERA a 7.20, whip of 1.76, 5 home runs allowed. But Rainey ended up striking out the final 9 batters he faced while pitching for AAA Rochester, and now he has struck out the first 6 batters he has faced in his latest go-round at the major league level. So Tanner Rainey now has struck out 15 consecutive batters, 9 at the AAA level, 6 at the major league level. I know you can't just combine the two levels like that, but that's something else. 15 consecutive strikeouts for Tanner Rainey. Each of the last 15 batters he has faced, he has struck out. That's something else, man. I mean, that's pitching in a zone. You know, that's being locked in. And as bad as Tanner Rainey was prior to being optioned to AAA Rochester on August 1st, don't forget, Tanner Rainey last season was really good. Tanner Rainey was one of the biggest bright spots on the Nationals pitching staff in the 2020 season. Rainey in the 2020 season, 20 and a third innings, ERA at 2.66, a strikeouts per 9 innings of 14.2. He had 32 strikeouts in just 20 and a third innings last season. This season had not been going well. Maybe, just maybe, Tanner Rainey can be a guy who ends this season on a high note. But man, he has been electric over these last two outings here in his return to the major league level. Game 2 for the Nats at the Marlins Tuesday night at 6:40. It'll be Rogers versus Rogers for the second time in a week. Josh Rogers versus Trevor Rogers. Well, believe it or not, we on Monday night had a shutout win for the Orioles. Yes, a shutout victory for the worst team in the majors. 2-0 the final at the Philadelphia Phillies in game 1 of a 3-game series. Shades of the 1983 World Series. And so, Joe Angel, if you would.
And the Orioles again in the win column.
Yes, Joe, it's always nice to hear that. This was the Orioles' first shutout win since July 18th. O's now a Major League worst 48-102. Two things from this game. Number one, John Means was great. Means in this win on Monday night, 6 2/3 scoreless innings. He had 6 strikeouts versus 1 walk. He gave up just 4 hits, all of which were singles. He threw 65 strikes versus 40 balls on 105 pitches. And Means had a hit. He, in the top of the 7th, had a 1-out double off the center field warning track on a 1-2 pitch. And that ended up being the only extra base hit in the game. Yeah, if you're an O's fan, you're not used to this. A 2-0 game. I mean, so many of these Orioles games this season have been slugfests, or at the very least, games in which the opposing team has put up a bunch of runs, but not on Monday night. The run prevention was certainly there. John Means was terrific. And this continues this like mini renaissance for John Means, who was excellent early in the season, then kind of tailed off. But Means now has been at least decent in each of 5 consecutive starts. Now, he's not back to his dominant self. He's not back to his American League Cy Young Award contender self, who we saw earlier in the season. But he has been better here over these last few weeks, and he was really good on Monday night. Means now on the season, 24 starts, 138 2/3 innings, has an ERA of 3.25, has a whip of 0.99. I mean, he by far has been the Orioles' best starting pitcher this season. And while it's still hard to say, like, on a good team, is John Means an ace? I still would say probably not. But on a good team, I think he's a decent number 2 and a really good number 3. And he pitched really well on Monday night. So full credit to John Means. Also in this Orioles 2-0 win at the Phillies on Monday night, Austin Hayes strikes again. So Hayes was actually the Orioles' leadoff man on Monday night, with both Cedric Mullins and Trey Mancini not starting. Hayes was the Orioles' starting left fielder. He had a single and a walk, continuing his recent good hitting, but he also made a nice catch. Austin Hayes made a fully extended backhanded catch of an Andrew McCutchen liner for the third out in the bottom of the fourth. Austin Hayes is a really good defensive corner outfielder. I've talked about that a bunch on the podcast. Hayes entered games on Monday tied for seventh in the majors among all qualified outfielders with plus 10 defensive runs saved, and we saw some of the great defense on display there. Game two for the O's at the Phillies Tuesday night at 7:05. All right, that will do it for you and me, but just for now, keep the feedback coming. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. Wednesday show, episode 150. We expect to have plenty from Ron Rivera on Tuesday to chew on, as we will have the latest on the Washington football team and this Sunday afternoon's game at the Buffalo Bills. Have a great rest of your Tuesday, and I'll talk to you on Wednesday.
But come on, guys, use your freaking common sense one time. It's a brutal freaking play. It really is.